ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Annie Guest, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, damage control. Susan Lee stares down leadership speculation after one Liberal colleague insists she's losing her party's support. Also, Lebanon slams Israel's bombing of Hezbollah targets inside its borders, despite the ceasefire deal. And as Queensland considers reclassifying an apex predator as a domestic species, are we ready for dingoes to mix it with the pampered pooches down at the dog park?
One is completely embedded in Australia's ecosystems and has been for thousands of years, and the other one humans have shaped into the perfect couch potato.
The Liberal leader, Susan Lee, has fronted the media to stare down claims she's losing support amongst her colleagues. Liberal Senator Sarah Henderson says the party is in its worst shape in a decade, casting speculation Susan Lee could be toppled from the leadership. But a number of senior colleagues have hosed down the speculation, which has been fuelled by the party's failure to make a decision on net zero. The Liberals are due to meet next week to settle their position, which will then need to be negotiated with the Nationals. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
With a big smile, opposition leader Susan Lee addressed the media in Canberra with a plan to end her party's division on net zero.
Next week, the Liberal Party room will assemble. The working group that I set up 6 months ago has completed its work and it's ready to present to our Liberal Party.
Victorian Senator Sarah Henderson, who opposes a net zero target, isn't happy it's taken this long to resolve the issue. This morning, accusing Susan Lee of poor leadership since the party's election loss in May, she spoke on Sky News.
As a member of parliament, I can't pretend things are good. I do have to say, really honestly, I do think Susan is losing support, but I do believe in miracles. We can turn things around. I'm not calling for Susan to be removed as leader. I am just saying that I do believe she is losing support because of what's happened since she became leader. I can't sit here and pretend everything is okay. It's not okay.
Susan Lee later addressing the allegations she's losing support within her own party.
I'm not focused on comments that other people relay to me or that might be made in a variety of contexts. The only thing I care about is working hard for the Australian people. I value every single member of my team, including the good senator that you've just mentioned.
Net zero is causing deep division within the party, with opponents of the policy arguing it could cost the coalition the election. But today, a succession of senior Liberals dismissed Senator Henderson's comments. Shadow Energy Minister Dan Tehan says he's confident the party will agree to a policy ahead of next week's Liberal Party meeting.
No, it's not losing support. What this has always been about is about policy. Colleagues have been saying a variety of things over the last few months. What I'm focused on is making sure we get the policy right.
Here's Liberal MP Tony Passon speaking on 5AA Radio in Adelaide.
It's clear that a majority of my colleagues are moving to the position that I and other South Australian Liberals have held for a long time, and that is to remove ourselves from the net zero.
Richard Alston was former Minister for Communications under the Howard government.
Look, I think all political parties go through these sorts of processes. I mean, every time there's a pre-selection, people will say, if it's contested, they'll say, you know, it's an absolute dogfight. So I think you just have to ride with the punches on politics.
He says with another few years before the next election, there's plenty of time for the Liberal Party to resolve its issues.
It's not our finest hour by any means, but it doesn't mean it's the end of the road or anything. There's cycles in politics, and I think we're facing a reality of having to win 26 seats in the next election, which is highly unlikely, but nonetheless, you've got to give it your best shot, and there's plenty of time to settle things down before then.
Charlotte Mortlock is founder of the Hilmers Network, an organisation recruiting women to the Liberal Party.
Susan, I think, is doing an incredible job, and she actually is really aligned with Liberal values.
I think there's been this series of double standards where, you know, they can commit to net zero, as they all did under the Morrison government, but Susan can't.
Last week, the Nationals abandoned a commitment to reach net zero emissions by 2050 in a unanimous party room decision. National Senate leader Bridget McKenzie says her party will give its coalition partner the space to discuss the future of net zero before they both meet next week.
They need to be free to have those discussions internally to reconcile within their own party where they stand, and then we can have a conversation about the coalition more broadly.
National Senate leader Bridget McKenzie, ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. $1,000 billion is a big figure to get your head around, but it could be one man's pay packet. Tesla shareholders have voted in favour of a performance bonus scheme that could see Elon Musk become the world's first trillionaire. The deal requires Mr. Musk to achieve a series of milestones in order to achieve the massive payday. Business editor Michael Yander joined me earlier. Michael, what's the package and what does Elon Musk need to do in order to receive it?
Yeah, so Annie, it's about 423 million shares if he gets all of them and meets all the performance hurdles. They would be worth around $1 trillion, making Elon Musk potentially the world's first trillionaire. They come in 12 tranches, and each tranche has performance hurdles that have to be reached to get that set of shares. Some of the short-term ones are fairly achievable, like lifting the market value of Tesla to $2 trillion, which sounds like a lot, but it's already worth $1.5 trillion, so that's not so far away. Tesla needs to deliver 20 million electric vehicles, 10 million self-driving subscriptions. That's a bit further off because self-driving cars are still illegal in most jurisdictions, 1 million Optimus robots, and none of those are yet in service commercially, so that's still a bit of a reach target, and 1 million operational robo-taxis, the cyber cabs that Tesla has rolled out in Austin and is about to roll out in Miami, Dallas, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. But to get 1 million of those on the road still looks several years off at the best.
As you say, no certainty in the near future in particular, but what about other shareholders? Was everybody supportive?
No, the vote in favour of the package was 75%, just over 75% of shares. Now, Elon Musk owns 15% of the shares currently, so that was a big whack in favour. A lot of big institutional investors also voting in favour because of the threat that Elon Musk might walk away from Tesla if this package was rejected. A lot of these kind of share bonus packages get almost consensus or certainly above 90% approval, so 75% is not that high. Several shareholders spoke out at the meeting, and there were shareholder resolutions to try and rein in the power of Elon Musk at the head of the company, and also what they see as a board that doesn't necessarily represent the interests of smaller shareholders. In fact, the New York State Comptroller was speaking in favour of one of those motions, which was voted down, and he said that Tesla's board is one that refuses to act as an independent check on management, where of course management is largely Elon Musk.
And this could potentially one day increase his holdings from 15 to 25%. So what does it reveal about Tesla's future plans?
Look, Tesla really sees itself as a leader in the artificial intelligence and robotics space. If you listen to Elon Musk at the AGM today, the electric vehicles, they're sort of the basis of the company and have got it to where it is, and they hope to continue growing that. But the future, as he sees it, is not only these cyber cabs and autonomous driving, but particularly the robotics. This Optimus humanoid robot, which came out dancing to join Elon Musk on the stage. You know, he was joined by a series of dancing robots. Well, he's hoping in the future that they will do far more productive things, potentially even surgery, replacing human surgeons and making surgery more efficient and more accessible to humans across the world. And of course, we know Elon Musk's space ambitions. We also know his AI ambitions, and Tesla today passed a motion to invest in XAI, which is a private company controlled by Elon Musk. So that's clearly where he wants to direct the future of Tesla, is artificial intelligence, robotics, and really being the dominant player in those sectors globally.
That's business editor Michael Gyanda. In a fresh escalation in the Middle East, the Israeli military has carried out heavy airstrikes in southern Lebanon, saying the Iran-backed terrorist group Hezbollah is trying to rebuild its military capabilities there. The Lebanese health ministry says one person was wounded in the bombing and another was killed in airstrikes earlier in the day. The United Nations peacekeeping force says the attacks are a violation of last year's ceasefire agreement. Alison Chow reports.
The night sky flashes bright orange as plumes of smoke rise from Zatar al-Sharqiya in southern Lebanon. Israeli jets struck three towns in the region after residents were urged to leave. Farid Nanou is the mayor of Tir Deba, where one building was hit.
After the enemy failed to achieve its objectives, I saw that today it has gone back to hitting civilians' homes. If things are heading this way and continue like this, then all hope is lost.
Israel says it targeted Hezbollah weapon storage facilities and is accusing the terrorist group of trying to restore its military capability. Shosh Bedrosian is an Israeli government spokeswoman.
Israel will continue to defend all of its borders. We will not allow Hezbollah to rearm themselves, to recover, build back up its strength to threaten the state of Israel.
Lebanon's president condemned the latest attack, calling the heavy airstrikes a fully-fledged crime. Hezbollah has been urging the Lebanese government not to enter negotiations with Israel. But pressure has also been mounting on the Lebanese army to step up its efforts to disarm the Iran-backed group. Dr. Ali Mamouri is a Middle East analyst from Deakin University.
We know that there was a significant push on the Lebanese state to disarm Hezbollah. There was some kind of diplomatic pressure, economic pressure by US and other allies, but so far there wasn't any success. It seems that Israel is trying to use the strategy of carrot and strike to put pressure on Lebanese government and state in the hope that some kind of move will happen on the other side.
The renewed strikes by Israel come after a ceasefire deal last year to end more than a year of fighting between Israel and Hezbollah.
It's unlikely that we'll make some kind of change on that matter because Hezbollah is not on the position to strike back. But it will cause more instability and it will cause more conflict inside Lebanon.
As Israel steps up attacks on Lebanon, it's also trying to normalize relations with other Muslim countries. The Central Asian country of Kazakhstan, which already recognizes Israel, has announced it will become a signatory to the Abraham Accords, which are a series of US-brokered normalization agreements between Israel and several Arab nations. Dr. Ali Mamouri says it's largely symbolic and is a sign of a new tactic from US President Donald Trump.
The main focus was on Saudi Arabia, but after failure in that matter, it seems that they are using a new strategy now, bringing other countries, smaller and minor countries, to make some kind of quantity pressure and gradually make the accord alive and push it forward.
That's Dr. Ali Mamouri from Deakin University, ending that report by Alison Chow. This is PM. I'm Annie Guest. After years of criticism of racism among police, the Northern Territory now has its first ever strategy to deal with it. The NT Police Commissioner says the force has confronted some hard truths about its past and must face them head on. The strategy flows from the high-profile coronial inquest into the police shooting of Yuendamu man Kumanjai Walker. Northern Territory reporter Eleni Roussos joined me earlier. Eleni, take us through what's in this police anti-racism strategy.
The strategy is the culmination of work by Leanne Little. She's a former police officer, an Arunda woman who was born and raised in Alice Springs, who was appointed to the Northern Territory Police Force as the head of cultural reform to essentially do just that and investigate racism in the force and to see what needed to happen on a structural level also to bring about change. So Ms. Little has this week released the force's anti-racism action plan, and it has a few objectives. Some of the key ones are to deliver anti-racism training for all police employees and to boost Aboriginal employment across all staffing levels to 30%, and it's 30% to match the population of Aboriginal Territorians. There's also a goal to review the way that police collect and analyse data and statistics to, quote, eliminate racism. On Thursday, Annie, the Northern Territory's new Police Commissioner, Martin Dole, was in Alice Springs with Leanne Little to announce the action plan. Here's what he had to say.
This strategy is not a witch hunt. It's a pathway forward. It's about building a police force that truly reflects the territory that we serve, where every officer and every Territorian is treated with fairness and respect.
And that's the NT Police Commissioner Martin Dole. And Eleni, can you just remind us, the strategy flowed from the investigation from Leanne Little. Can you remind us what sparked that investigation?
Annie, it was the high-profile coronial inquest into the police shooting death of a young Aboriginal man, Kumanjai Walker, in Yuendumu in the Northern Territory in 2019 that made public racist attitudes in the Northern Territory police force. And it was that inquest that ultimately sparked this review by Northern Territory Police. Leanne Little is an Urundu woman. I asked her, you know, how difficult has it been for her personally to do this work with the police? And here's what she had to say.
I got brought up tough. I've been a former police officer. I know how the system works. I think this is probably one of the hardest jobs that I've ever had to do in my life. But I see that opportunity as a privilege, and you know, I want to see change, and I can see change already happening, as I have said, with a lot of officers coming forward and reporting matters.
That's the NT Police Force's Head of Cultural Reform, Leanne Little. And just to note that Zachary Rolfe was acquitted of the murder of Kumanjai Walker. Eleni, the Northern Territory Chief Minister has denied that systemic racism is an issue for the force. What does that mean for this strategy?
That's a good question, Annie. The Chief Minister, Leah Fenocchiaro, she's also the Northern Territory's police minister, and she has gone on the record to deny systemic racism being an issue in the force. We asked Leanne Little whether or not the Chief Minister's position puts this strategy at risk, and we were told that that's a question that we need to put to the Chief Minister. We have tried to seek comment from the Chief Minister, and we're waiting for that at this stage.
That's Northern Territory reporter Eleni Roussos. Despite what some foreigners might think, Australians don't ride kangaroos to work or keep dingoes as their pet. That might soon change in Queensland, where the state government is considering reclassifying dingoes as domestic dogs. But scientists, traditional owners and dingo conservationists say that could be dire for both people and dingoes. Angus Randall reports.
With their sandy yellow fur, pointy ears and a bushy tail, they wouldn't look that out of place at the local dog park. But experts are divided over whether a dingo is a dog or something else entirely.
One is completely embedded in Australia's ecosystems and has been for thousands of years, and the other one humans have shaped into the perfect couch potato.
Dr. Kylie Cairns is a dingo genetics researcher at UNSW.
A lot of taxonomists and some scientists thinking that dingoes are a domestic dog and therefore should have the species name Canis familiaris. And there's other scientists, I'm part of that group of scientists, that think dingoes are not the same as domesticated dogs and so they should have their own name.
Queensland is considering changes to biosecurity regulations that would classify dingoes as domestic dogs, meaning they could be kept as pets. It's a big upgrade from its current status as an invasive species, which equates dingoes to rabbits and foxes. The review is an attempt to fix a contradiction in law, which sees dingoes as invasive under the Biosecurity Act and native under the Nature Conservation Act. If this proposed change is made, Dr. Cairns says anyone who decides to bring home a dingo puppy for Christmas is in for a steep learning curve.
They're just more wild, so they don't do well with new environments and having visitors as well as domestic animals. They're much smarter, they're much better able to escape.
In New South Wales and Western Australia, there are very few restrictions on owning a dingo, while Victorians require a licence. In other states, owning a dingo is outright banned. Dr. Kylie Cairns says if Queensland changes its rules, it needs to bring in a licence system.
They do perform a really important ecological role in the bush, and removing them and putting them into a home is a poor outcome for a dingo and a poor outcome for the environment as well.
Simon Stratton runs Durong Dingo Sanctuary, northwest of Brisbane. He's worried about the consequences if anyone can own a dingo.
You've got to have at least, you know, 2 or 3 years' experience with dingoes by going to someone's sanctuary and volunteering there and all that. The thing is, the dingo will escape. It'll always find your weakest link. It'll run up down the road. Might chase someone's cow, it'll get hit by a car.
Sonia Takau is a Dhirubal woman and the founder of First Nations dingo rights group, Dingo Culture.
It's a slap in the face to us as Aboriginal people when all you Westerners all come along with your ridiculous ideas.
She says her ancestors have lived alongside dingoes for thousands of years. She views the relationship as a partnership rather than animal and master.
You know, you have to be a special qualified person to be an owner of a dingo. Or, you know, we don't own them to be a companion. But once they commit to you, they're very loyal companions, you know, and they're your companion for life.
Consultation on the proposals closed in October. A State Department of Primary Industries spokesperson says Queensland's biosecurity laws were being reviewed ahead of legislative amendments coming into effect in April next year.
Angus Randall and Rudy Maxwell. Well, if you're hoping to tune into Sounds of Nature this weekend, you could help tally the world's largest croak count. The Australian Museum's annual Frog ID Week gets underway today. It relies on people across the country to record frog calls so scientists can monitor their health and distribution. The annual count has even helped uncover new species. Isabel Massali prepared this report.
If you hear this near your place, or this, or maybe even this guy, then get out your phone and record it because they're the top three most wanted frog calls. That's according to the Frog ID team at the Australian Museum, who run the massive citizen science project. For the next week, they're encouraging the public to gather scientific data that helps frog conservation efforts.
Frogs themselves are kind of tiny and you might not think they're important. They're a huge part of healthy ecosystems. And so we definitely need frogs around. They help keep pest species down. They feed all our beautiful birds and mammals. And they're incredibly important.
Dr. Jodie Rowley is the Australian Museum's lead scientist for Frog ID. She explains you don't need to specifically find the frog. Just record its call by using the free app.
The best places are freshwater, so your dam, creek, pond, stream down the road. And the best time is the first few hours after dark, but they will often call during the day and all night. And the best way to locate where the frogs are, of course, is by their calls.
And it doesn't need to be a rare frog to make a difference.
So the most iconic Australian frog, I think, is your good old green tree frog. And throughout most of Australia, you'll hear these guys sort of...
Since the project launched about a decade ago, Australia's so-called froggers have recorded more than 1.3 million calls. It's helped scientists describe 13 new frog species, track species distribution, and identify new populations. In New South Wales, amphibian biologist Dr. Gracie Liu has been researching a small endangered frog that lives in streams.
Our team rediscovered the Burralong frog in parts of the Northern Tablelands where they were presumed extinct for about 40 years. You know, Frog ID data can really help with that because if there's someone out there armed with a smartphone that, you know, chances upon this frog and they manage to record their calls, you know, we'll be able to listen to that and verify, you know, if it is a Burralong frog, and that can really help with species discoveries. But also, I guess, more generally, having this huge database of frog calls means that we can do all sorts of research on it.
Dr. Simon Clulo isn't involved in the Citizen Science Initiative, but uses the data. He's an associate professor in conservation ecology at the University of Canberra.
I feel my entire life is Frog ID Week. I just call it Frog ID Life.
He says about 20% of Australia's frog species are threatened.
It's largely to do with a disease, a fungal disease called chytrid that swept Australia and the world. It's an invasive pathogen. But also a lot of other common threats like habitat loss and global warming is starting to really impact frogs as well. So it can be a little bit dire. And so it's really important to be able to get records of where frogs might have disappeared from and no longer occur, as well as where frogs may have even recovered.
Dr. Simon Clulow from the University of Canberra, ending that report by Isabel Massali. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is Nick Grimm. Technical production by David Sargent and Joram Toth. I'm Annie Guest. We'll be back on Monday evening. Hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When do you know you've made it? Well, the head of the chip-making giant NVIDIA must have a fair idea. The company's value topped $5 trillion last week. He's not alone. Two other tech giants have also hit the $4 trillion mark. So when's the bust coming? Today, the ABC's chief business correspondent, Ian Verinder. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.